Situation at Fukushima escalated significantly today. Explosions were reported in two more reactors and a fire started in one of them.
Japan's battling a nuclear emergency, with the government confirming two partial meltdowns may have taken place at the quake-damaged atomic power plant.
The magnitude 8.9 earthquake that shook northern Japan in March caused a massive tsunami that killed thousands and flooded the Fukushima nuclear power plant. When the wave hit, the Fukushima plant lost its backup generators and its ability to cool down nuclear material. A number of fires broke out and radiation began leaking into the atmosphere. The crisis in Japan has raised a number of questions about nuclear power, its safety and its appropriateness in quake-prone areas like Japan. Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and today on Rear Vision, here on ABC Radio National Summer, we're taking a look at the history of nuclear power and nuclear safety. But before we do that, let's try and get our heads around how nuclear power works and how it is that splitting an atom can generate so much energy. Barry Brook holds the Sir Hubert Wilkins Chair of Climate Change at Adelaide University and is the author of Why We Should Say Yes to Nuclear Power.
Well, when you split an atom, you release energy by converting some of the mass of that atom into pure energy. If you're doing something like burning coal, that's a chemical reaction. It's a totally different process and it produces about one millionth of the amount of energy you get from splitting an atom. So it's a tiny amount compared to that, which is why nuclear power is so incredibly concentrated. The key is, of course, controlling that incredibly dense energy production.
A major breakthrough in atomic science came in 1938 when Dr. Lisa Meitner and Professor Otto Hahn split the atom of uranium-238 in their laboratory in Germany.
It was certainly very exciting, but back at that period, people couldn't really understand how to make practical use of it.
John Carlson was the Director General of the Australian Safeguards and Non-Proliferation Office from 1989 to 2010.
It was really only with the onset of the Second World War, and it was known that German scientists had been doing a lot of research into nuclear physics. The very famous incident of Einstein travelling to the United States to convince the US president that there was a competition on and that if the Allies did nothing, Germany would develop a way of using nuclear energy for a weapon. That was really the birth of large-scale research into finding out how to use nuclear energy.
The nations of Europe were at war. The search for the secret of the atom's power was concentrated on the development of a bomb.
The famous Manhattan Project, which absorbed something like 10% of the US economy, I think, during the Second World War, and many thousands of scientists and engineers.
The research paid off, and in August 1945, in the dying days of World War II, the Americans dropped two nuclear bombs on Japan. This demonstration of nuclear power ended the war in Asia and the Pacific and ushered in the beginning of the atomic age.
On the bulkhead of the USS Enterprise, the first nuclear-powered aircraft carrier in the world, is a plaque honoring the Greek philosopher Democritus. He was first to suggest that all things were composed of particles, which he called atoms. The sharpest sword could not cut them, he said. They were unseeable, indivisible. Unseeable, yes. Indivisible, no. Out of the bursting core of the unseeable atom, scientists and engineers have released a source of energy surpassing anything ever before known or imagined. A boundless physical force with power to reshape the world and the lives of everyone in it, now and in the future.
Well, through the late 40s and early 50s, there was a lot of work done at the national laboratories in the US. And in Britain, and the Soviets were also developing these power reactors. But they were for the purposes of scientific research and for developing material for nuclear weapons and so on. The first real commercial, well, not quite commercial, but non-weapons role for nuclear power came when it was recognised by a member of the US Navy, Admiral Rickover, that a nuclear power reactor would be an incredibly useful thing in a submarine, because submarines had always been plagued by the problem that they had to come up for air in order to run their diesel motors. If you could have a nuclear power reactor, it doesn't require any air, it doesn't combust oxygen. So in theory, if you had that, you could stay underwater for as long as you wanted. So that was a huge motivation for him, and it led the National Labs, in collaboration with the US Navy, to develop the first nuclear submarine.
At the present time, we lead the world in nuclear propulsion knowledge. We have proven the superiority of nuclear-powered ships. Out of the unseeable atom, scientists and engineers of the Navy and the Atomic Energy Commission, working with leading industries, have developed and demonstrated the greatest power the world has ever known.
In the late 1950s, after the first successful test of these nuclear-powered submarines, they essentially beached a submarine reactor at shipping port in the US, and that was the birth of commercial nuclear power. They were essentially submarine reactors, and later they developed them and they got them bigger.
Initially, when nuclear power was developed, the nuclear bomb and the potential of using it for electricity generation as well, there was a debate amongst scientists and to some extent amongst politicians as to whether nuclear energy should be made widely available to as many countries as possible or should be kept top secret and confined to just the countries that already had it, which at the end of the Second World War was only the United States and the Soviet Union. And in fact, one of the very first, I think it was the very first agenda item for the United Nations when the United Nations was established in 1946, was looking at whether nuclear energy should be controlled by the United Nations. Neither the United States nor the Soviet Union wanted to see that happen, and they concluded that secrecy was the best way of controlling the technology.
The United States knows that if the fearful trend of atomic military buildup can be reversed, this greatest of destructive forces can be developed into a great boom for the benefit of all mankind.
U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower, addressing the United Nations in 1953, in what has become known as his Atoms for Peace speech.
When we came into the early 50s, by that stage, the technology had already spread to a number of new countries, the UK and France. U.S. policy changed, and the feeling was, if things kept on as they were, nuclear capability would gradually spread to more and more countries, and that would result in a very dangerous world. And it was better to establish an institutional system which would control nuclear energy and ensure that it remained in peaceful use. So the United States developed this concept, Atoms for Peace, where the technology for power generation would be made widely available so that all countries that wanted to benefit from electricity generation could. But in exchange for that, they would have to give peaceful use guarantees that would be under international supervision, and from the Atoms of Peace concept developed the idea of international safeguards. The International Atomic Energy Agency was established in 1957, and a system of international inspections came into being to verify that countries using nuclear energy were doing so for exclusively peaceful purposes.
1953 is when Eisenhower made his famous Atoms for Peace speech. That was in December, and then the following spring, Congress in the United States passed the Atomic Energy Act of 1954 with an incentive program to try to convince utilities to go nuclear.
Stephanie Cook is the author of Immortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age.
But what happened then was that utilities are not real risk takers. A few of the bigger ones were willing to do this, but then they started scratching their heads and saying, what about insurance? There was a General Electric official who said that a nuclear accident, this is back in 1954, that it was entirely possible for damage to exceed the corporate assets of any given contractor or insurance company. So this government program to promote nuclear energy then became dependent on the taxpayer to basically back the risks of a huge catastrophic accident, with the utilities chipping in a minimal amount. But basically, the larger consequences of an accident would and still would be paid for by the public.
With the backing of governments and the dream of electricity that was too cheap to meter, a number of developed nations began establishing a nuclear power industry.
Through the 1960s and 1970s, there was a huge amount of interest in rapidly expanding the use of those sort of reactors for commercial electricity. The demand was growing very quickly, the population was growing, and the economies were expanding fast, and they knew there was going to be a large amount of electricity needed. So that went on for a number of decades in places like the US and Europe, and it's when most of its reactors were built. So in a period from the late 50s to the mid-70s was when most of the reactors in places like the United States and Canada and much of OECD Europe was built. In the last 25 years, not much has happened in those countries at all with nuclear power. Instead, fossil fuels have reasserted their dominance, and coal and gas continues to be most of the capacity that's built. And it's only been now in the Asian countries like Japan and South Korea and China and India that are actually really pursuing large amounts of new nuclear power.
1966, you get your first real orders for reactors starting up, about five in that year. And then the boom starts in about 1968. And it really only lasts till 1974 in terms of orders. And the last order, one of the big misnomers in all the discussion over here, I don't know about in Australia, but everybody here says, well, Three Mile Island ended the nuclear boom. That's not true. The nuclear boom ended easily a year, if not a few years, before Three Mile Island. And the reasons for that was that were several. One was that the oil crisis created high inflation and high interest rates, and the cost started to go up. And then there were all these unforeseen costs just building reactors, because they turned out to be a lot more complicated.
Nuclear power is the only energy source where governments decided to develop it before there was a market for it. So the United States and France both push nuclear power development as ways to show the world that you could do it.
Benjamin Sovacool is assistant professor at the National University in Singapore and the author of the forthcoming book, Contesting the Future of Nuclear Power.
From its very start, there was a very political agenda behind promoting nuclear power. And in each country that's considering a nuclear renaissance today, you see elements of these kind of fantasies or these kind of grand visions and nationalistic ideas taking place. In India, you see nuclear power sold as a way to make the country great, to stop fight poverty, to make sure that everyone has what they need. In China, you have it attached to notions of military greatness and economic competitiveness as they talk about exporting it. In the United States, you still have people talking about the next generation of reactors that will take us to, again, a future age where electricity will be metered, but it will be much cheaper, you know, than other sources. And I think that that's kind of a key part of nuclear power. It's so complicated and hard to do that we're proud that we can do it, right? I mean, I know a number of nuclear engineers who are legitimately proud by what they're able to do. It's miraculous. And I think that part of that plays into countries want it. They view it as something that is very sophisticated, and they want to belong to a sort of club.
Sure, that's true of just about any energy technology you could ever imagine, that most of them have been developed on a large scale with government inputs. For nuclear, it's interesting because it's hard to disentangle the money that went into general nuclear atomic research for weapons and that which actually went into commercial power. And from weapons, I mean both the atomic bomb and the nuclear navy. But it's inescapable that a technology that has been proven at an engineering scale must have investment from government as a public good to get it to the point where it is a commercially viable technology.
You're with Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince. And today, as Japan comes to terms with its worst nuclear disaster, we're taking a look at the history of nuclear power.
The world has never known a day quite like today. It faced the considerable uncertainties and dangers of the worst nuclear power plant accident of the atomic age.
Veteran US newsreader Walter Cronkite, reporting on the Three Mile Island nuclear accident, 1979.
The whole story of the nuclear accident, now being called the worst ever, has been confusing. Spokesmen have issued deliberately conflicting reports. On Thursday, no one had been exposed. The following day, six people had been exposed, and yes,
the accident at Three Mile Island is often cited as a turning point for nuclear power in the United States, the moment the industry went into freefall.
Well, in the US, it was often ascribed to the accident at Three Mile Island. But if you study the history of nuclear power in America, you find that isn't actually the case. The last reactor that was commissioned was in 1975, 4 years before Three Mile Island. So nuclear power was essentially dead in the US 4 years before Three Mile Island. And one of the fundamental reasons seems to be that early estimates of the cost of nuclear power were too optimistic. And fossil fuels were remaining much cheaper than people had realised. So there was a great fear in 1973 with the first oil crisis that the cost of all fossil fuels was going to accelerate rapidly. And so they had to look for alternatives. And so this was a big incentive for investment in nuclear and renewables at that time. But that incentive then petered out by the late 1970s for both nuclear and renewables. And so by default, sources such as coal and gas have won and continue to win.
And first, the Soviet Union has admitted there's been an accident at one of its nuclear power stations.
A wave of radiation swept over the Scandinavian countries, with Finland...
Moscow itself has been telling the world a little more about the fire which is burning out of control at a nuclear reactor near the city of Kiev.
The accidents at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl were due to operators overriding automated systems. But I do think, though, that we have to look at the risk of nuclear energy relative to the risks of other energy sources, and I don't agree that the consequences of a nuclear accident are far worse than any other kind of accident. The consequences of a large dam collapse, for instance, could be horrendous, and we have had some of those in the past. You know, if you have a major earthquake which results in the destruction of something like the Three Gorges Dam, then you would have millions of casualties. And I'd also make the point that as regards coal burning, which is so well established in our world, it's not so much a risk of harmful effects as a certainty of harmful effects. There's a harmful effect every day coal-fired stations operated from the discharge of particulates into the atmosphere, which affects people's lungs, and from the effects of CO2 increases in the atmosphere and how this affects climate. So I think we have to do a proper comparative analysis of the pros and cons of all energy sources.
We have a partial picture, and I say partial just because, like most industries, this nuclear industry isn't very forthcoming about accident data. With the Fukushima plant, it only became apparent a few weeks ago that in the 1970s they'd had a series of accidents that they actually never told anyone about. And they had an accident in 1999 at one of their uranium enrichment facilities that killed people that they also took 4 years to disclose. So there is a kind of asymmetry of information where, of course, the authorities that run these plants know about all the accidents, but the public doesn't. But if you do take the publicly available knowledge, with all of those caveats, you do get a good sense. There have been about 4,000 so deaths related to nuclear power. The far majority of those, like almost all 4,000, were the result of Chernobyl. You've got about less than 100 deaths affiliated with nuclear power, with other incidents and accidents that killed two people here, three people here. Now, what's interesting is we've done a study at our center on energy accidents over the past 100 years, where we've looked at nuclear compared to all other energy systems, hydro, coal, oil. Now, what's interesting is how you measure accidents. If you look at the frequency of accidents, which energy system breaks down the most, nuclear is doing pretty good. Your natural gas pipelines and your oil infrastructure, oil pipelines, oil tankers, oil refineries, break down more frequently. If you're talking about fatalities, it's hydroelectric dams that actually can kill the most people because their reservoirs break, they cause massive floods. There was a single event in China that killed more than 100,000 people because of a dam failure in the 1970s. But if you look at cost, which technology costs the most and causes the most property damage, it's nuclear power. Even though nuclear power only had a small fraction of the overall accidents over that 100 years, it amounted to almost half of the costs. And that's because reactors themselves deal with high amounts of radiation, and you have to do things like evacuations or containment, or you have to abandon entire facilities when a big accident happens. And that ends up costing, we predicted, about $330 million every year.
No industry is free of incidents. In fact, hundreds of incidents occur in our industries every day that the public don't hear about. They are a matter that are regulated by various government authorities, and no industry is immune to that. The key metric, I guess, that it should be judged against is that how well regulated is the industry, and the nuclear industry is amongst the most heavily regulated of industries, and indeed amongst power production industries, it is by far and away the most regulated, so that any incidents that do occur are much more likely to be found and reported. And then the firmer metric to measure this against is whether those incidents, be they in the dozens or hundreds, have actually caused harm to the public. And the only incident that's caused harm to the public has been the Chernobyl incident. That's the serious incident that's occurred, and all other incidents, be they in the dozens or hundreds, have not endangered the public.
You have to look at it from a different perspective. How do people live afterwards? You have people in Japan right now that are facing either not returning to their homes forever, or if they do return to their homes, living in a contaminated area for basically ever, and knowing that whatever food they eat, it might be contaminated, and always living with this sort of shadow of fear over them that they will die early because of cancer induced by cesium or strontium or some other radionuclide that's laced their vegetables. It affects millions of people. It affects our land. It affects our atmosphere. We know now the radionuclides from Fukushima are going into the sea. It doesn't just kill now, it kills later, and it could kill centuries later, because the stuff that's depositing doesn't just end. It has a long, long life. It's affecting future generations. It's not just affecting this generation. So I'm not a great fan of coal burning. I don't think any of these great, big, massive plants that spew pollution into the air are good, but I don't think it's really helpful to make these comparisons just in terms of number of deaths.
Japan's battling a nuclear emergency, with the government confirming two partial meltdowns may have taken place at a quake-damaged atomic power plant. About 200,000 people have been evacuated from residential areas around the Fukushima plant.
Now, what happened in Japan was a few things. First is that when they designed these plants, they never thought there'd be an earthquake of the magnitude and size that hit northern Japan. So they actually had planned for about a 3 to 6 meter tsunami, which means when they located their backup generators, they put them at about 10 to 12 meters above sea level, thinking, of course, there's never going to be an earthquake that will cause a tsunami that large. Unfortunately, the actual tsunami wave at this site was about 14 to 16 meters. So that was one of the big design flaws, was that all of the backup generators, which should have been able to withstand the earthquake and keep the nuclear's fuel and the nuclear reactors cool as they shut down, malfunctioned. The second big issue is containment and shielding. The Fukushima plant in Japan is somewhat unique. What's unique about that plant is it relies on what's called MOX, mixed oxide fuel, which is reprocessed fuel. They reprocess because they want to get more bang for the buck out of their fuel, which then means that the spent fuel can degrade a little bit differently. It's kind of like using, you know, recycled materials. They're not as strong as the initial type. So that type of fuel ended up being very volatile and ended up decaying in ways that the planners of the plant didn't anticipate when they lost those backup systems. And I guess the third issue is that no one had ever foreseen the need to actually contain the spent fuel facilities. These are the casks of spent fuel that actually started to release radioactive material directly into the atmosphere, because there was never a situation in which planners thought they would be without cooling water. Because you don't have to just cool reactors. You also have to cool the spent fuel on site for a few years before it's cool enough that it can go to a centralized repository.
Before the event in Japan, no member of the public had ever been killed by a reactor in an OECD country. And, you know, 12 days later, that's still the case, that no member of the public has been killed by the Fukushima Daiichi incident. People are scared about incidents at nuclear power stations, and yet, when you look at it compared to the number of members of the public that are killed each year from fossil fuels, it's an incredibly safe technology. It hasn't harmed a member of the public. And that's interestingly because it's provoked some well-known environmentalists to come out in support of nuclear energy and saying, well, I would prefer alternative options. I would prefer to go for wind and solar and expand these, but I treat the problem of climate change very seriously and the need to address that. And I look at the safety record of nuclear power and find that even under the most duress, it's still actually doesn't endanger members of the public in a significant way, then it's worth that risk-benefit trade-off.
Reactors certainly have more safety features than they did in the past, but you can only make reactors so safe, and you can't design against every eventuality. Who would have thought that backup power would be a problem when it came to a disaster like Fukushima? And yet that was the cause of the accident. The sequence of events in a nuclear accident, the potential sequence of events in a nuclear accident, are literally unquantifiable. There are just so many different permutations of what can happen. You know, humans are humans, and ultimately humans run these machines, or they design these machines. And there's going to be somewhere where somebody slips up, where some designer didn't think of something, or where the human operating it doesn't think of something, or somebody falls asleep, or, you know, you have to say to yourself, are you willing to take the risk that if something very, very badly goes wrong, your life as you know it will be gone because that reactor happens to be only 50 miles from your house?
60 years ago, people dreamt that nuclear power would create a world where electricity was available to everyone and would be too cheap to meter. Today, only 15% of the world's electricity is generated by nuclear power. So in light of the accident at Fukushima, does nuclear power have a future?
Precisely because nuclear plants are so capital intensive, they lock you in to that type of supply chain for electricity for many years. I think we are going to see a roughly stable supply of nuclear electricity for the next 5-10 years. You'll probably see still around 10 to 15% of the world's electricity coming from existing reactors. And that partially makes sense because many of these reactors are less than 20 years old. You have fuel contracts that you've signed. You've already paid off half of the plants. You'll probably have an increased focus on safety post-Fukushima. But for the large part, you'll see about 440 reactors at least staying on the online for the next, you know, 5-10 years. However, what I think you'll see is that the share of overall contribution will shrink. Those 440 reactors will stay, but electricity demand is set to grow significantly. And already in Europe, in Asia, in North America, the fastest growing sources of electricity are wind, solar, and natural gas. And I think these will eat away at the margins so that you won't see much growth of nuclear energy. And in fact, over the past 3 years, you've actually seen a net decline, although it's a slight decline, a net decline in the amount of electricity that nuclear power does. In terms of kind of long-term thinking, I think Fukushima will probably have a force a serious debate in Japan about the future of their nuclear reactors, and will probably have some spillover into China, maybe Russia, maybe the United States. But I think will be somewhat limited only because the industry has done a very good job already of talking about how the crisis has been contained. It's very unique. It will never happen again. It was a once-in-a-lifetime situation. And because we'll probably never know the true extent of damage. I mean, I was doing research last month on Chernobyl, and they're still finding out things that they didn't know at the time of the accident that were suppressed by the Soviet authorities. So I guess as long as the industry is able to control the flow of information, and as long as the meltdown is able to be contained, I think you'll have some fear in some countries, but probably not enough to stop existing nuclear power plants from operating. What will be the future battleground will be these decisions we make about what new sources of electricity to build between now and 2030.
Benjamin Sovacol, author of the forthcoming book, Contesting the Future of Nuclear Power, ending today's program. Our other guests, Stephanie Cook, who is the author of In Mortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age. John Carlson, former Director General of the Australian Safeguards and Non-Proliferation Office. And Barry Brook, who holds the Chair of Climate Change at Adelaide University. Thanks to sound engineer Simon Branthwaite. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National.